Zen and the Art of Self-Mutilation. This is adapted from a letter Jed McKenna wrote in reply to a self-professed serious seeker who made an impassioned offer to turn over his belongings and himself in exchange for being accepted as Jed's student. Dear William, you don't need to add me to your equation. You need to subtract yourself. Begin by re-examining your assumptions. It's clear from your letter that you consider yourself a serious person, a serious seeker. That's the first assumption you'll want to challenge. You're sure that a serious seeker is what you are, and you think, I see you that way too. But this is not the case. I know serious when I see it, and I know a hand puppet of Maya when I see it. You think you're on top of something, but the only thing to be on top of is Maya, and she's on top of you like a house on a mouse. I receive many offers from people who want to come be with me. Maybe anyone perceived as a spiritual solution provider receives this kind of offer. I wouldn't know. People want to give up everything, their stuff, their money, their very lives, really. They don't know what to do with them, so I guess they figure, why not dump them on someone who seems more qualified? Like a mother leaving her baby on the rich man's doorstep. This may appear to be the ultimate sacrifice, a grand act of selflessness, but it's really the ultimate entrenchment. Fear gone haywire, ego solidifying its hold for decades to come. This isn't how you surrender the self. This is how you abandon it, abdicate responsibility for your own life. I understand this can be a very tempting response to a very perplexing challenge. Nevertheless, your gesture suggests that you're in an uncomfortable place. Good for you. That's always the best place to be. Being so uncomfortable means you'll soon have to move. That's good. That's the motivation that drives the journey of awakening. It's a series of steps, none taken voluntarily, all necessitated by the kind of discomfort that causes you to write your letter to me. The motivation behind your letter is good, but throwing yourself at me is not a solution. What would I do with you? What possible instruction could I give? Maybe I would tell you to cut off 1 ounce of your body every day until you can answer the question, what is true? Any ounce, as long as it's an ounce. That should bring you quickly into focus, light a fire under you. If you had to do this, cut off 1 ounce of your body every day, how much time do you think you would waste on meditation, on attending satsang or reading the latest spiritual bestseller? Not bloody much. You would soon become an enlightenment machine. Sleep and food would be reduced to barest minimums. Relationships and activities once deemed essential would be forgotten. You would enter into a burning mania of single-pointedness. Soon, anything other than the question, what is true, would seem comically irrelevant. There's your new Zen. Zen for the new millennium. It would be interesting to see how many sand gardens and books of pithy aphorisms the self-mutilation approach sells. What is true? That's the only koan there is, the only one anyone ever needs. Every day you don't answer this question, another ounce. Take a moment to think about what it would mean to have to sit down with a scalpel at a certain time every day and amputate 1 ounce of your body. You would quickly have to learn things about asking and answering, about how the process works and doesn't work, about how to help it, and how to get out of its way. You would have to learn how to unlearn, and you would need access to a tremendous amount of resources in order to accomplish such an unlearning. You would discard clever spiritual concepts for cold facts, pretty Eastern vocabulary for words of scientific precision. The process is one of seeing clearly, not just blindly lashing out. That act of seeing clearly takes time and resources, and the mind must work almost ceaselessly at levels far beyond the everyday. Would this work? Well, let's say it did. Say it worked in 500 days. There you are after hacking off over 30 pounds of yourself. And now your truth realized. Now you know directly, for yourself, without the slightest possibility of error, the truth. You are free from delusion, awakened from the dream state. You have joined the ranks of the spiritually enlightened. You look at your toeless feet, fingerless hands, noseless face, earless head, and what would you say? Here's what you'd say. Well, that was kind of dumb. I'm happy to tell you that right up front. Waking up is kind of dumb. There's no point. It's not merely pointless, it's pointlessness. Who would do such a thing? Only someone who absolutely couldn't not do it. Once you become the person that can't not do it, it's a whole different thing. But trying to do it before you absolutely must is as ludicrous as slicing off parts of your body. Which, by the way, don't do. As barbaric and unthinkable as this ounce-a-day approach may seem, I can assure you that anyone who has ever managed to awaken from the dream state was driven by equally unendurable mental and emotional forces. Something to consider the next time you hear the pop guru du jour recount the moment of his glorious epiphany. I was walking in the park. Children were laughing. Birds were singing. When all of a sudden, this is where the process of spiritual autolysis comes in. Spiritual autolysis is ultimately about clear seeing. Clearly seeing what is, which is what we do when we stop seeing what's not. We can use SA to raise the ordinary powers of the mind up to the extraordinary levels necessary in order to see life and the world and ourselves as they truly are. Many people can build nuclear reactors, compose symphonies, conquer nations, or perform brain surgery, but very few can see what is. You mention in your letter that Alan Watts said that we are the apertures through which the universe sees and experiences itself. It might be more useful to say we are the imperfect lens through which the universe, or the I-universe, observes itself, through which the undifferentiated creates the illusion of differentiated. It's an amusing idea to play with. Self is distortion. Distortion by design. The exact distortion of the lens is what makes the exact individual. Distortion itself is self. All personal attributes, understood this way, are flaws, imperfections, in a lens that exists to be imperfect. Imperfection does not otherwise exist, so an artificial imperfection is created. Ego. Seekers may strive to become a perfect lens, but, of course, the perfect lens is no lens, no imperfections, no lens, just what is. Your imperfections are not only who and what you are, but why you are. The finiteness and the imperfection of the lens are the reasons for the lens. No lens means the universe goes unbeheld. So, what has been accomplished by this act? Who is served? Who benefits? This reinforces my earlier statement that awakening is pointless. Trading segregated self for integrated no-self, finite being for infinite non-being. All this by way of saying not that perfection is unattainable, but that it's unavoidable. Perfection is. It is what is. There is no other. In truth, there is no such thing as non-perfect or imperfect. The point of finite and imperfect lenses is to create artificial realms of finiteness and imperfection in which to play. The original letter cites an Indian saint to bolster an argument, and then proceeds as if the words of the sage were accepted fact. Don't come at me brandishing dead guys like potent allies. It doesn't help you. They can't put up a fight. If you can't make the argument, you can't summon the dead to make it for you. That's a logical fallacy called ipsa dixit. He himself said it. In law, it's called the dead man's statute, and it's inadmissible. You can't elect a ghost proxy. You're borrowing authority from someone who is incontestable, not by merit, but by death. Your argument is unassailable because the person making it is unavailable. You're saying that if he were here, he could make the argument, but he's not here. You can borrow words and ideas and quotations from the terminally absent to help you illustrate a point, but if it's your point, it's your problem. Your argument to make. In any case, if he were here, he couldn't make the argument. I'm familiar with the beloved teacher of whom you speak. I promise you that if he were here, I could slice him into a garnish while rubbing my tummy and patting my head. No effort required. No contest. You could do the same by this time tomorrow if you'd stop being lazy and start thinking for yourself. Your spirituality is just another false garment, another layer of the lie of self. Your spirituality defines the dimensions of your cell, and the fact that you don't see that tells me that you have no idea where you are or whose rules you are living under. You have no grasp of your true situation, of the nature of your captive status. You're clinging desperately to your lies, shielding them with emotional energy. Why? Because these lies are you. They are who you are. You don't have imperfections. You are imperfections. Ask yourself why you even write to me. What's the point? None of what I'm saying is new to you. And yet, here you are, writing impassioned letters to me, trying to stand your lies back up on their feet. If you like your lies, fine. But you're not going to make them true through the power of your conviction. Who you are is a lie. That's a fact. You're a fictional character in a state of wondrous denial. What you think of as your uniqueness is really nothing more than a series of randomly set toggle switches, and the particular settings you call me amount to nothing more special than the distinction between any two snowflakes in an endless blizzard. A serious person must remember at all times where he is and who's running the show. This is Maya's house. She controls everything. She has every advantage. We are patients in Maya's asylum. And all instruction to sit still and quiet the mind come directly from her. Stillness and silence are the antithesis of the awakening process. And those who advocate peace and compassion and a quiet mind are just reselling their preferred sleep potions. There are even popular spiritual teachers and authors who advocate doing nothing at all. They say that effort itself is the problem, that the discontentment that drives the spiritual pursuit is the only thing standing between ourselves and the goal of the pursuit. Is it any wonder that such a message would be popular? Is there any doubt from whom such a message really comes? You indicate in your letter that you believe a teacher's lineage is important. So there's the one true lineage, Maya. If you wish to understand any spiritual teacher's lineage, you need only imagine him dangling from marionette lines of which he is unaware, spouting off about free will, the hand of Maya above, controlling everything. Even as you write to me, and I write to you, we are dissolving in a vat of corrosive chemical called oxygen. We are genetically programmed to self-destruct. Our lives are being swallowed by time, and every inhalation may be the last. The inescapable fact is that we are all practitioners of the new Zen I described above. Every day we lose an ounce, or a gram, or a pound, and someday, poof, gone, as if we never were. There's only one koan, and it's the same for all of us. What is true? Yours, etc. Manahata. I was asking for something specific and perfect for my city. Whereupon, lo, up sprang the aboriginal name. Walt Whitman, Manahata. I like Manhattan too much to ever live there. The most I ever do is visit for a few months. That's what I'm doing now. The time is summer 01. The Twin Towers still stand, but not for long. The first book, Spiritual Enlightenment, The Damnedest Thing, is written, but not yet printed. I've spent the last few months house and dog-sitting in Puerto Rico. When I decided to go to the city, I called my sister, who lives there, and set up a lunch. As it happened, she said, she knew of a 3-month availability on a Tribeca loft if I needed a place. She told me that her friends who owned it were desperate to find a tenant because their arrangements through a house-swapping agency had fallen through at the last minute. But they were going on their trip anyway. That's fine, I told her. I'll call Rodney and ask him to put it together. You don't want to see it first? She asks. You're saying it's okay, right? Yes, but so it's fine. I'll see you for lunch next week. That's a clear illustration of two widely disparate modes of operating in the world. The distrusting way of the segregated self and the trusting way of the integrated self. My sister would have had to inspect the apartment, haggle about price, maybe call in experts to inspect this and that, find alternatives to keep her options open, put deposits in escrow, and get a lawyer to sign off on the lease. She might refer to the owners as friends, but, as she would say, business is business. This is the falsest of economies, because the only thing she's saving is money, while wasting her only true wealth. Her life force, with all that dreadful fear-based strategizing and maneuvering. It's not really about money, of course. It's about self-image. That's not just how she'd lease an apartment. That's how she does pretty much everything. She lives in a universe where 100 bad things could happen in every situation. Her state is one of constant vigilance. She spends her life imagining everything that could go wrong and making sure that it doesn't. To her, the universe is a hostile place in which, though she'd never phrase it this way, she does not belong and has no rights or power. And yet, most anyone would consider my sister a bright, attractive, and very successful woman. What I've just said about her is just as true of many other people, and more so of most. This mode of operation appears like a systemic malignancy to me, cancer of the life, but probably seems normal and acceptable to most people. It's not a starkly pronounced fear. It's more a damp sort of dread that seeps outward from the center into every corner of one's being. When you're living with it, it just seems normal. Once free of it, you can't believe you ever lived like that. To me, it's the simplest thing in the world. I'm going to the city, so I pick up a phone and find a place to stay before I even thought about finding a place to stay. I get what I want before I know I want it, and better than I would have thought to want. I never take this sort of effortless functioning for granted, and I'm permeated with deep and genuine gratitude many times a day. I've arrived at this place of smooth flow mainly by being respectful, by watching how things work, and by keeping my fearful little reptile brain out of the equation. I don't have much in the way of distorting mental or emotional baggage that I haul around with me, so I guess that allows everything to work as it's supposed to, smooth and easy. Does all this make me a sucker? A soft touch? Not really. Should the deal go bad, or the lessors try to hold my deposits unjustly, or any of the many things that can go wrong in this type of arrangement do go wrong, then I'd just make another phone call. I'd set a pit bull lawyer on them with instructions to cause regret. Or maybe I'd just shrug and blow it off. I never know how I'll act until I do, because I don't have any rules or guidelines to tell me how to behave. Or maybe just one. Patience. Breathe. Give it time. Allow things to settle out and for patterns to become clear. The point I'm trying to make is that I'm not necessarily a sweetheart of a guy. I could be a total prick, at least in theory. But I must say, there doesn't seem to be much call for it. I don't think about things like this. Deals going sour, people betraying people, pit bull lawyers, and they really never occur in my reality. There'd be no point because there's nothing in it for me to learn. So when I make a call and my sister tells me she knows of a place, I already know all about it. I know it will be ideal, that the owners will be easy to deal with, that it will be in a better area than I would have chosen, and that all sorts of other good things will come of it. Not because I orchestrated it with my snazzy little brain, but because I didn't. And if it appears to line up nicely, and then falls through, then I wouldn't suspect that something didn't work, but that something bigger and better is at work. I have no rule that makes me a nice guy. I have no rules. Rules are a way we have of defining ourselves, of drawing imaginary boundaries. Such boundaries are artificial and easily erased. Our most strongly held convictions can be wiped away like a layer of makeup through a moment of transcendence or cataclysm. or merely by a slight shift in brain chemistry. Morals, ethics, I have none. As it happens, I'm a nice guy. If it happens another way, I'll be another kind of guy. I could make the impassioned assertion that I'd never, under any circumstances, cause anyone harm. But events might change, and for some reason, I'll have to push some kids in front of a train this afternoon. I doubt it, and I hope not, but maybe. Yes, it's unimaginable, but that doesn't make it impossible. Unimaginable stuff happens all the time. I have a way of operating in the world, and it has nothing to do with rules, not mine or anyone else's. It has to do with trust and patterns and the absence of artificial boundaries. If those poor little children need to be pushed in front of that speeding locomotive, and that fact becomes clear to me in the way that things become clear to me, then we're going to need a cleanup crew with strong stomachs and a lot of little bags. You'd think that I could say with certainty that nothing so terrible could ever come to pass, and I'd certainly bet heavily against it. But it's not a sure thing. Terrible things do come to pass. An objective observer of humanity might say that terrible things are closer to the norm than big, happy things. Why pretend otherwise? Suffering and horror are part of life in the dream state. A big part. No, I don't really think that the universe will have me push children in front of a train this afternoon. That lets me off the hook, but not the children. The universe probably won't use my hands for it, but it will still push those kids in front of that train. I wouldn't suggest that just anyone can attain to supreme mastery in the art and science of manifesting desires. I know I haven't. But I would suggest that most anyone, whatever their circumstances, has plenty of room for improvement. I understand that there are influencing factors: gender, race, place, wealth, health, karma, dharma, luck, and others that can play a crucial role in the degree to which any individual might realistically hope to elevate, redefine, or undefine themselves. But I also understand that a lot of people are carrying around a lot of crappy crap they don't need, and which serves only to limit their potential for expansion. Some people dabble with this sort of wishcraft and reject it when it doesn't work for them. They wish for $1 million or something equally juvenile. And when it doesn't appear, they write the whole subject off as, well, wishful thinking. There's right wanting, and there's fear wanting. And $1 million is fear wanting. Right wanting is genuine and represents a true unfolding of one's unique pattern. This is no small point. Discovering right wanting within yourself is the journey of unbecoming who you aren't. Another point I have to make before I move on is that nothing I talk about, whether it's truth realization or our true relationship with the universe, is anything other than that which is naturally, rightfully, immutably ours. This isn't stuff we have to go out and learn or earn or fight for. It's simply what is. The Zen master who wrote as his own epitaph, "All my life I have sold water by the river. Ha! What a joke!" was addressing exactly this point. This is natural. This is what is. Reality is beyond our wildest dreams and it can all be yours because it already is. The only thing in the way is you. So I took the apartment for 3 months with the intention of wallowing in high culture for a while. Theater, museums, libraries, good restaurants. I'm very comfortable doing all these things alone. It wasn't actually working out as I planned, but other, better things were working out very nicely. So I was happy enough. This was a few months before the World Trade Center was attacked. So pre-9/11 normalcy still existed. The apartment was actually a renovated warehouse space. Lots of sandblasted brick, rusty iron, and big timber. Very large and airy inside, with walled-off bedrooms and bathrooms and everything else. Kitchen, dining room, formal and informal living areas. Open. A circular stairway led up to a railed upper level at one end where the owners kept books and a small home office. Not much of a view from the big industrial windows, and it was furnished with more of an eye toward style than comfort for my tastes, but still a very nice living space. Around this time, I received an email from Jolene, who had by now seen herself portrayed in a pre-publication copy of Damnedest. She wanted to see me, to speak with me. She had enough money saved up to make the trip and wanted to come for a few days, even, she said, if she could only spend a few minutes with me. I replied with a suggestion that she buy a backpack and a Eurail pass and go spend the summer bumming around Europe instead. She liked that idea and said she'd try to do it, but would still like to see me first. I agreed, and after a few emails back and forth, her plans start taking shape. A week or so before her visit, she called to tell me her flight number and arrival time, but she hasn't found a place to stay yet. Without thinking, I told her that the loft has plenty of room and she could stay there while she's in town. Really? She said. Great! A split second later, my mind caught up with my mouth. Hold on a second, I tell her. I cover the mouthpiece with one hand and rub my temple in a slow, circular, what the fuck did I just do motion with the other. I have to speak with your father, I tell her. Is he there? Yeah, she says hesitantly. You've been up front about this trip. Nothing tricky? No, they know what I'm doing. Okay. Put your father on. Okay, she says nervously. But don't tell him, you know, don't tell him anything important. I understand. Put him on. After a few moments, her father comes on the line. I introduce myself, and we speak in a respectful Mr. Last Name manner. He has some idea of who I am. Jojo talks about you often enough, Mr. McKenna, he says, not sounding very pleased about it. I tell him that I thought it was a good idea for him and me to speak so I could introduce myself and assure him that I'd keep an eye on his daughter while she was in the city. I was painfully aware that everything I said sounded wrong, like a guilty person trying to sound innocent. But there was no help for it. Of course, talking to her father was not strictly necessary. Jolene was old enough to do what she wanted, but that wasn't the point. The point was to head off a mess before it became one. I was actually somewhat grateful for the error that prompted me to speak with him, though, because I now realized it's something I should have done anyway and hadn't thought of. He seemed somewhat pleased to hear from me, but was still guarded. Maybe he was a bit relieved to find that this character who had lured his daughter into some crazy cult thing sounded fairly sane and responsible. Just a guess. Jolene and I were speaking just now, and I'm afraid I made a bit of a mistake. In reply, he just humphed. I offer to let Jolene stay with me while she's in town. I have plenty of room here, and it seemed like the safest and most sensible thing. But, of course, I immediately realized it might look, well, a bit inappropriate. I thought I should discuss it with you. There was another low sound from the other end of the phone, but I wanted to finish saying my part before he started on his, so I plowed on. Of course, it would have been easier to simply withdraw the initial offer, but appearances aside, it's really much for the best that Jolene stays with me, and, after a moment's consideration, I realize that the only real concern appearance-wise was her parents. I have no reputation to protect, or if I do, it could probably use some spicing up anyway. Jolene's reputation should be safe, because she's not a big mouth, and because no one who knows her would believe anything raunchy about her anyway. This situation is exactly what I'm sure Jolene has told you it is. There's nothing, I grope for a word and end up using a dumb one. Romantic and all this. In any case, I shouldn't have made the offer, and I'll certainly respect whatever your wishes might be on the matter. He doesn't jump in. So I continue, wondering how I got myself into such a dim-witted mess. I could help her find a hotel, or a nice hostel, or maybe she could be accompanied by a family member who could also stay in my place. Whatever. Now he speaks. Are you asking me? I cut him off. I know exactly what he means because that's how this whole thing sounds to me, too. Like a veiled petition to court his daughter, or to secure his blessing for something weird. I roll my eyes and plod on. I'm just telling you the situation. Whatever you say is how it'll be. I made this offer to your daughter in the spirit of friendship and concern. It's a very large apartment I have here, and the city can be a tricky place. Dumb. Just plain dumb across the board. But that's the situation, so I don't kick myself too hard. We talk a bit more. He gives it a bit of thought and decides I sound okay, and that his daughter has some funny ideas, but she's a good kid. And if we're going to do anything inappropriate, it probably wouldn't matter what he thought of the living arrangements anyway. And that it would be easier for him and his wife to know that JoJo wouldn't be completely on her own in the city. My sense of it, though, is that he isn't so much concerned about these housing arrangements as he is of the larger issue of his daughter becoming a stranger, and of me as the guy who might have caused it. He thanks me, a bit half-heartedly, and we leave it at that. The Journey to the Shaman. I could have met her at the airport, or I could have sent a car and had the driver waiting for her, holding up a sign with her name. That probably would have given her a thrill. The thing, though, and this is an important thing, is that the journey to the shaman is as much a part of the shamanic experience as the visit with him. I'm not a shaman, of course, but the adage fully applies. This kid has gone through whatever it takes a young farm girl from the Corn Belt to track me down, scrape up cash, break away from family and home, and get on a plane to one of the world's most intimidating urban centers. In short, to embark on a great journey. An itch in her head must have grown into a torment to necessitate such a journey, and I'm not about to diminish that by hauling her up the last few feet. My part starts with buzzing her in. It's not supposed to be easy. I return from an art house showing of the winter guest, to find her asleep, using her backpack as a pillow, at the elevator gate. I don't want to wake her, and I can't go past her without making a racket. But I also don't want to stand out here, watching a string of saliva trickle down the zipper of a side pocket. The dilemma resolves itself when she peeks out of one eye, and then the other. "Oh, hi!" she screeches, and jumps up and wipes her lips and wraps me in a hug. "Hi, hi, 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 hi!" I hi back and break away, and ask with avuncular concern if she made it in one piece, which I can see she has. We get her settled into the extra bedroom. I give her the spare set of keys, and we go for a walk around the neighborhood. We find a nice Mediterranean place for dinner and discuss her plans over olives, feta, lamb, and rice. We don't get into anything she refers to as important. There'll be time for that, and she has other things she wants to do while she's here, which we also don't get into too much, but I can tell she's going to do some looking around. She's happy and upbeat on the outside, but beneath that, even an unastute human observer like myself can see she's got serious matters on her mind. I particularly enjoy being with people in this state of mind, because it means they're dealing with serious issues. But there's no rush about anything, so I keep the conversation light and cheerful and try to help her relax. Kill the Swiss. The next morning, she's up late. I know she brought a bunch of books and a folder of internet printouts, and that she's working at reading and writing to get herself to some resolution. So that probably kept her up into the small hours. I get her seated at the raised breakfast bar that's a part of the kitchen's island counter, pour her some juice, and get started cooking her an omelet. As we animate these householder characters and inhabit this scene of domestic routine, she begins to talk about important stuff. She starts sharing her views on Buddhism with me. After a few minutes of listening to her, it becomes clear that she's trying to sell herself on Buddhism by trying to sell it to me. It's also clear, from the eagerness with which she's trying to sell it, that she has reservations that have not yet resolved themselves into focus for her. She talks to me in the way that suggests that she's really trying to convince herself of something she knows better than to believe. That's how desperation works. The frightened heart seeks to overrule the doubting mind. Fear overshadows reason and gives rise to faith. I don't say anything. I finish her omelet and put it in front of her and allow her to go on. She started out with a life is suffering thing, but that's hard to pull off if you've never missed a meal or had a physical ailment more grievous than a zit. She then edged briefly into some bodhisattva thing about not resting until all sentient beings are liberated, which made us both grimace a bit. Then a few words in praise of mindfulness and tranquility. And now she's talking about compassion. I could tell her that compassion is just another way of keeping our attention turned safely outward rather than destructively inward. But if I don't interrupt, I'm confident that she'll hear the same discordant note in her words that I hear and talk herself out of whatever she's trying to talk herself into. She might need me to listen to this, but she doesn't need me to respond. She's entering Buddhism along a circular drive, and if I don't interrupt her process, she'll soon be back out on the road, disappointed, but ready to continue the journey. She winds down and picks at her omelet. "Jolene, pretend there's a big red button on the counter, okay?" "Okay," she says, perked up by a new game. If you press it, you kill everyone in Switzerland. She gives me her reserved, lip-biting smile. Okay, she says warily. If you press it, no one will ever know. You'll never be blamed or connected to the deaths of all those millions of nice Swiss people. Yeah, she says. So? So why not press it? She brightens and begins to answer immediately, then darkens and bites down on her bottom lip to hold the answer in. This is like one of those goofy morality questions they ask you in the seventh grade. Like, would you turn in a friend for shoplifting? Except, I'm not trying to teach her morality. I'm trying to help her get past it. She's looking for a safe haven, and she hopes she's found it in Buddhism. But some part of her knows she hasn't. Here's the thing they don't tell you about compassion. Maybe because they don't know. Compassion has nothing to do with awakening. It's unrelated. It sounds good, and it's a tough thing to take a stand against, but it's a total disconnect. The golden rule of compassionism is do unto others. The golden rule of awakeism is think for yourself. There is no such thing as a Buddha of compassion. If you're compassionate prior to awakening, that impulse indicates an area where something false needs to be hacked away. If you're compassionate after awakening, you're not awake. If you're holding out for the awakened state that includes compassion, maybe you'll find Buddhism a comfortable place to kill the time. I watch Jolene. I don't know much about human beings, but I can see what's going on in her head. The first thing she realized is that this question has something to do with what she came here for, even though she hasn't told me what that is yet, and she may not be sure herself. Next, she started mentally scrolling through the obvious answers. They're innocent people. It's just plain wrong. I'll roast in hell, etc., without settling on one. After that, she would have looked for less obvious answers. Karmic imbalance, European destabilization, leaving the Alps unattended. Found none, and is now, or I miss my guess, revisiting the obvious one. She looks very frustrated at her inability to provide a simple answer to a simple question. The reason for picking on Buddhism is to better understand Maya. It's her thing. We all buy into the notion that in order to awaken, an intermediary is required, an intercessor. But the only intercessor is Maya. Kill the intercessor. Kill the teacher. Kill the Buddha. DIY. You have eyes. You have a brain. Do the math. Look for yourself. This isn't one way. It's the only way. That's why I've taken measures to make sure no one can glom onto me, to appoint me their personal savior, to wedge me in between themselves and reality. That's our natural tendency in these perilous waters, to reach out, to grab something, to attach, to put something between ourselves and the threat of eternal nothingness that lurks just beneath the surface. We want to maintain the illusion that we are not completely alone on an infinite sea, but, of course, that's exactly what we are. And there ain't no we about it. I'd feel terrible, Jolene says at last, making it more of a question than an assertion. I give her the mean look, and she squirms and goes back to work. Whatever she answers, I'll give her the mean look. I don't want her to answer it. I just want her to think about it. I want her to take a hard look at obvious answers. What could be more obvious than the reason for not pushing a button and killing millions of innocent people? And yet, why should I press it? Jolene asks. Maybe that's the better question. I don't need a reason not to press it, since I don't have any reason to press it. I'll just go on as if there's no button. Or maybe there's no reason not to press it. Is that what you're saying? Fuck it. I press the button, right? Those are evasions, I reply. Neither of those are the answers to the question. The question is, why not press it? I don't know, she says. Why not? Hell if I know. She slams her fist down on the imaginary button and gives me a mischievous smile, like she might have just done something terribly naughty. Oh, well, I say ruefully. There goes yodeling. Never cared for it, she says through a big, toothy grin. After a few days, we've settled into a routine and see each other only in passing and for one or two meals a day, usually out, usually a walk or short cab ride away. Jolene has been doing a lot more with her time here than just hanging out with unhip old me. She's been getting out and networking. Once she had her arrangements in place to be here for a week, she started using the internet to figure out where she wanted to go, including some temples, some Eastern and New Age bookshops, and at least one mystical coffee shop. She branched out from those starting points. She'd talked to people and followed leads. She hasn't made much headway with the subway, so she's throwing a lot of money at cabs and zigzagging around the city and burrow hopping rather haphazardly and surely expensively. She hasn't kept me updated on her activities, but I can imagine. If she's been visiting temples and speaking with monks or nuns, they might have treated her like a cute little tourist girl visiting the big city from the farm belt for about half a howdy-do, but then they would have found something unexpected. They would have found that cute little 98-pound Jolene has the hunger. She doesn't want the tour, and she doesn't want the brochure. She wants very specific answers to very specific questions. If she can't get them to come out of the gentle monk's mouth, she'll crawl into his brain with a flashlight and a pickaxe to see if they're in there. If she doesn't find what she's looking for, the monk will become as disposable as a gum wrapper. I know all this because I know the hunger, and I know what's growing inside Jolene. She's not looking for new friends. She's not looking for general knowledge or pleasant experiences. She's getting into a very serious frame of mind, and her appetites are getting very powerful and very specific. I don't mean to get another vampire thing going here, but it's a wickedly good analogy.